billion people, no doubt we'll agree, this world is our home, not your property, it's the commons, our right of birth. And you would enclose the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall, when we cut this ball and chain. You'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores.
Good morning and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for July 12th. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. The impetus for today's program is recent news about the effort in Sacramento to create a public bank in California. That news, coupled with the shocker a few weeks ago that Facebook intends to introduce its own currency next year, led us to our very trusted source for all things banking and currency, Ellen Brown, who has been our guest a few times over the 10 years that Annie and I have been hosting the program, and coincidentally, whose 13th book was just published last month. So we have plenty to discuss today. Ellen Brown is an attorney and the founder and chair of the Public Banking Institute. She is also the author of 13 books, including the just published Banking on the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age. Two of her previous books are must-reads about economics and the benefits of public banking. One is called The Web of Debt, and the other, The Public Bank Solution. She also happens to co-host a radio program on PRN.FM. That's the Progressive Radio Network. It's an online station. The program is called It's Our Money, and her 300-plus articles are posted at her website, ellenbrown.com. She has degrees from UC Berkeley and UCLA School of Law. So let's look at the recent progress on public banking in California, the danger of Facebook's new currency, the Libra, and our guest's new book, Banking on the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age. Ellen Brown, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thanks, Steve. Great to talk to you.
So you must be pretty excited to have this measure in the state Senate right now. It's on public banking, AB 857. I guess it made it out of the assembly unscathed, and now it just made it out of the state Senate Governance and Finance Committee at 5-4, so it's not a slam dunk by any means, and now on its way to the Senate Appropriations Committee. So are we going to have public banking in California?
Well, we certainly hope so. That would be a first step. The point of AB 857 is to make it easier for cities and counties and the state itself to set up their own public banks. Right now, there are a number of barriers that don't really even shouldn't or needn't apply to a public bank that we're trying to get rid of. So the idea is to carve out a special charter for a public bank, and that's what AB 857 is all about.
I think Mendocino County tried to do that before by first step one, passing a county charter, and that didn't get anywhere. So this will be for make it certainly enable a lot of places that where there was interest before. What do you think about the provisions of AB 857? Is this what you would like to see exactly?
The original bill was definitely what I would like to see. Apparently, they now want to incorporate a feasibility study. That the legislators have added that, and we know from experience that feasibility studies tend to be where bills go to die. So it's been said. So hopefully that won't slow it up. But one thing that this bill has that we haven't had before is huge public support. We've got over 150 different organizations have endorsed it. The city councils and mayor offices are actually sending representatives to support it. We see articles that, you know, we had nothing to do with writing that incorporate our arguments, and legislators are incorporating our arguments. So we're very hopeful that this will fly. You know, we had a bill in 2011 that passed both houses of the legislature for a feasibility study, and it was looking really good, but the governor didn't sign it. But in this case, the governor Gavin Newsom has said that he supports a public bank and he thinks we need a public bank. So hopefully when he gets to his desk, he will sign it unless he gets, you know, a lot of pressure from big banks, which could happen. Who knows what happens behind the scenes. But even if, I mean, we're very hopeful, of course. So, but even if it didn't pass, many people are predicting another crash like the 2008-2009 crash. Apparently Deutsche Bank, as we speak, is going through the same sort of traumatic experiences that Lehman Brothers went through in September 2008, triggering that crisis. So if there is another such collapse this time around, it's highly unlikely that Congress will bail out the banks again because it didn't work that well the first time. So people will be looking around for other alternatives, and the groundwork will have been laid. We've raised a lot of public awareness on the possibility of the government itself forming its own banks. And what I've written about in this new book is that we really should have a national public banking system. It could all be tapping up the liquidity, the infinite, the deep well of liquidity of the central bank in the public interest. Right now, the central bank just is the head of the private banking system, and it does provide reserves for the banks, but it doesn't help the people or the local economy.
Yeah, of course, it would be much better to have this federal, but in the meantime, I guess we're looking at a state provision that might be helpful. And I should mention to our listeners that our state senator, Mike McGuire, is supporting this, and it did pass out of the most recent committee on a 5-4 vote with McGuire's help. I do think we should talk a little bit about the opposition that you mentioned. There's a lot of public support for public banking, but the big banks don't like it, and I think even the county treasurers are opposed to it. I guess they're so used to working with big banks. What do you think about that landscape?
Yeah, the county treasurers do tend to be the sticking point because they are in charge of the public's money. For one thing, they're concerned about it encroaching on their territory, I think, but also they're just very conservative. Their number one concern is always risk, and it's hard to persuade them that what we're talking about is not risky. We're talking about doing exactly what they're doing now, putting their money in a bank that has all the protections of a bank. In fact, we would say it has more protections because it's operating in the public interest. So unlike the big banks that have a mandate to serve their shareholders first and foremost and can do whatever they want with our deposits, including making all sorts of investments that are not only very risky, but that we may not approve of and that may actually hurt us, you know, things that maybe are polluting the atmosphere or whatever, a public bank would have the public interest in mind by mandate. So anyway, it's largely educational. We just have to get more understanding of why this is not going to hurt the state or the city, and why it's actually going to help, and why it's going to be safe. There are different possible models, but what we would recommend is that the public bank be making loans to cities and other entities with a tax base. So you know your customer. You're already making loans, revolving fund type infrastructure loans. The state, for example, is already making loans to cities or to, you know, right now the state of California has a infrastructure and development bank. It's called a bank, but it's not a depository bank. It's a revolving fund. So they have a certain amount of money. They lend it out at below market interest rates. There's huge demand for these loans, but they have very little capital, so they have very little reach. So you could expand that by a factor of 10 just by turning it into a depository bank and use that money for the money they have for loan money, turn that into capital. And at a 10% capital requirement, you could then make 10 times as many loans. And then as you built up your capital, you could expand and expand. So if you're making loans to public entities, you already know the customer. You know you know what the risk is. You're already making those loans. I mean, there are loan officers who have been making those loans for 20 years, and they've done very well, you know, prudent loans. They're not losing money, and they're making below-market loans. So anyway, it's largely a matter of education, and hopefully, if we do have a crisis, we can overcome those barriers, because what other option is there? We don't have... we've pretty much hit the wall in terms of raising taxes, slashing public services. There's no other source of money. We need a new source of money, and this could be it.
You mentioned that if the infrastructure bank, for example, took deposits, then you know you could do 10 times the loans and such. But those deposits would not be going into the conventional banks. So I assume so. Of course, that would build up opposition then from the mainstream banks. One of the sources of opposition.
Right, and we're talking Wall Street banks or big international banks, because the local banks just aren't big enough to handle even the funds of a city, let alone the funds of a state. Mm-hmm. It's complicated and it's big.
So I gather that there are some strictures on AB 857 about the size of the entity that could put in for the public bank under that law, but that small cities could group together. How do you see
that? Right. Well, that's just a matter of practicality, because there are all kinds of requirements. Like now we have... you know, requirements for just to prove, I'm not thinking of the word, but anyway, it's difficult to set up a bank, and a lot of hurdles you have to jump over. So, and you need a big capital base to get started. So I don't think it's in there to hurt the small cities. It's just that as a matter of practicality, they're probably not big enough.
Speaking of the crash that you mentioned, you know, so now it's been a little over 10 years. And regarding public banking, now there's one public bank that some listeners will recall from previous programs in the country, Bank of North Dakota. And during that time, in the years immediately following the crash, so 2009, 10, 11, 12, in that time frame, real estate prices had collapsed quite a bit. And the major banks weren't lending for several years, and so the proverbial middle classes, that were not homeowners, couldn't take advantage of the drop in prices. Do you happen to know if that was also true in North Dakota, or was that bank making loans at that time so that people, working people, could take advantage of the situation?
Yeah, North Dakota was the only state that escaped the credit crisis. It was unaffected. And for that reason, as you say, they were leveraging their own funds, and they have a mandate to serve the public interest. So they were making the mandate is not to make the biggest profit they can make, but to serve the public. And so they were still making the same types of loans, whereas the Wall Street banks were pulling in their horns, afraid to make those loans because they were losing money on them. Or I don't know about afraid, but anyway, they weren't making them. Mm-hmm. And there, because so that is the problem with the model that we have today. It's not really that banks create money, which some people want to eliminate that and just have some sort of federal institution which would create the entire money supply. But it seems to me the fact that banks create money is a good thing. What they're really doing is turning our own credit into something we can spend in the marketplace. So they're guaranteeing our own loans, and we need that. But the problem with the system is that the banks are privately owned, so they're creating money themselves for their own profits, and that means the credit is not going into the sectors that really need it. Whereas, so you could fix the system not by eliminating the banks or the ability of banks to create credit, but by making them public utilities that have a mandate to serve the public.
So you're in Los Angeles right now, and I think L.A. just tried to pass a public banking bill, which didn't quite make it, but people were still encouraged. Do you want to talk about the Bank of L.A.?
Yeah, well, that was last fall, and The bill did get 42% of the vote, which was pretty remarkable considering we had no money to start with to fund it. The bill was filed, or it was, to get voter approval, and it was put on by the city council. It wasn't by the public banking group. And so it was 3 months before the vote, or 4 months. Anyway, there was very little time to raise money. And still, it was all just people power getting out there and beating the bushes. This amazing millennial group that had taken up the cause after it started with Standing Rock and the push to pull our money out of Wells Fargo for starters, which is the bank where the city of LA has its deposits. And then the question raised by the city council itself was, well, we can't really do that because where else are we going to put the money if they put it in, let's say, Chase? Chase also has a litany of frauds against them. I mean, they settled all those cases, but they settled for big money, so you know there was some wrongdoing committed there. Anyway, so the natural alternative was a public bank, so that's why the public banking. PBLA, Public Bank Los Angeles group got behind it and were pushing it to the legislators, to the city council, and also just all around the city. So it really made a lot of progress. But and the president of the city council has said that, well, these motions always lose the first time around, but, you know, we'll bring it again. So there is interest in doing it again, but it will make it much easier to bring if we have a special public bank charter. So if AB 857 passes, it's definitely going to be an impetus for the city to bring their bill again.
And no particular
resolution.
There's no time frame for that that I've heard, or do you know of any?
No, I haven't heard either.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is the best horizon I've seen yet for public banking. We do want to follow you to the more important, you know, governmental, national public bank rather than just little pieces here and there. But we do want to take advantage of having you on in your aspect as a teacher to this dark science of economics. And we also want to get into your book, Banking on People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age, fantastically complicated information that you managed to boil down so that people can understand it. In my case, almost. The banks now work for big bankers as opposed to working for us. And so we're going to get into the a public bank for the whole country and talk about your book. And Steve is suggesting that first maybe you tell people a little about what really is the Federal Reserve so that people can kind of have a handle on a central bank. What does that mean?
Okay, well, the Federal Reserve was set up in 1913 really to backstop the banks. In the 19th century, there was one financial crisis after another. I read that it was on average every 6 years there was a financial crisis. And this was because the dollar was at that time backed by gold, and the banks did what they do now, create money on their books, and they created 10 times as much money as they had gold, knowing that people, for the most part, didn't come for their gold. But periodically, there would be runs on the banks because people would figure out that there wasn't enough gold there. They would have reason to question the validity of the bank, and then they'd rush in and pull their money out, and then there'd be a crisis. So the Federal Reserve was set up as a reserve to hold the gold, but also so that banks could draw on it as needed. But also a new system was set up where the Federal Reserve would issue the dollars instead of allowing banks to issue them. In the 19th century, banks could actually issue dollars with their own name on them, and it was called a bank note, which meant a promissory note, or in other words, it was like, this isn't really money. This is a promise to get money. It's a promise that you can come and redeem this note for gold whenever you want. And that was what was wrong with the system, that there wasn't enough gold. So the Federal Reserve, after 1913, became the issuer of the dollar. But first of all, the system didn't work, as we saw in the Great Depression, where we had a massive, the largest bank run ever, and all the banks were closing because people were rushing to pull their gold out, and that meant that all the loans that weren't backed by gold had to be called in as well. So then people couldn't get credit, and businesses failed, and you had the situation of people starving while food was rotting in the fields because there just wasn't any financial mechanism for moving it, for paying the laborers to pick it and to sell it, or any money to buy it. Anyway, so, but the Federal Reserve continues to be there to serve the banks, not to serve the public. And the banks get interest on their reserves as of 2008, and it's now up to 2.5%, which is, we don't get 2.5% on our deposits at all. So, and the reserves are basically our deposits, among other things, but not also the money created in quantitative easing that they can't really do anything with. So there's really two banking systems. The banks have all these perks, banking at the Fed, and then we are banking at banks that are only giving us bank credit and not really giving us real government-issued money, except for a little bit of cash if we want it. So that's the system that could be opened up, and there are proposals by, you know, economists and former treasurers, people working for the Treasury, et cetera, and the Federal Reserve, proposing that we could open up the central bank to everyone. If we could all deposit there, it would eliminate the possibility of bank runs because the central bank can't run out of money, and you know, it would solve many other problems. The big roadblock is the fact that everybody would then rush to put their money with the central bank instead of having it with Chase or whatever, and then the big banks wouldn't have the liquidity to make loans. But so what I wrote about was that, well, the central bank could also make loans. But, of course, you don't want to give the Federal Reserve, or we wouldn't have the capacity to do all the lending for the country. But if you had a national public banking system where you were basically getting your loan from your local franchise, your local public bank, and then that bank would have access to the liquidity of the central bank, so it couldn't go bankrupt. You don't have to worry about a $250,000 deposit limit or insurance limit, which is what has largely created the shadow banking system. That's kind of complicated. But anyway, it would solve a myriad of problems.
So the Federal Reserve is really a creature of the corporations rather than the government. And it doesn't,
right.
It doesn't have to be that way. I think it's sort of ethereal to most of us how the money is created out of debt. You've written about that. So the real money is when the banks get it back on interest. But in the beginning, when they loan it to you, they just make it up, basically. And I guess people are worried about, oh, well, what if the government had the central bank and they just made up the money? Then we'd have inflation and we'd all be ruined. But you see how this is done in Asia, and it works pretty well. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Well, 95% of the money supply is created by banks anyway. So we're just talking about what if the central bank created money that actually went into the local economy instead of the quantitative easing that they've done so far just went to the banks. And because the banks are banking in this separate system, it went into their reserve accounts, and they really couldn't get it. It really couldn't jump the divide into the local economy under our current system. But in Japan, in the U.S., the presumption is that the Federal Reserve is independent. So whenever, like, the president criticizes the Fed or whatever, everybody jumps all over the president for trying to curtail the independence of the central bank. So Congress can't make the Federal Reserve buy their bonds. They can spend with debt. But what it does is it just drives up the federal debt, and it worse than the federal debt, which it never gets paid off, and it never will be paid off. It's just rolled over from year to year, and it's not a big deal. The problem is the interest. The interest keeps going up and up as the debt goes up, and predictions are that in the next 10 years it'll be $1 trillion a year, which is going to break the taxpayers. So we want to get rid of the interest, and if the Federal Reserve bought those bonds, then the Fed is required to return its profits to the government, so it would basically be interest-free. And if the Fed never collected on the bonds, if they just kept rolling it over, it would be interest-free and debt-free. So it would basically be the government issuing money, but legislators seem to feel more comfortable calling it debt. So you could call it debt, but it's a debt held by the Federal Reserve, which the Fed could agree not to collect on. So that's what they do in Japan. In Japan, the banking laws are actually different. They say that the Bank of Japan and the Ministry of Finance, which is basically the Treasury, have to work together in forming monetary policy. So the Treasury can say, or the Prime Minister can say, we are going to do massive stimulus. But, you know, can agree with the central bank ahead of time. We're going to do this massive stimulus, and you're going to buy our bonds. And they can reach an agreement on that ahead of time. And then, and that's what they have done. And 50% of the government debt is now held by the Bank of Japan. And it not only has not created inflation, but they can't even get it up to the 2% that they're aiming for. And in China, it's a little different. In China, the law says that the government itself is in control, so that the central bank is essentially working for the government, so the government can call the shots. But also that the government owns 80% of the banks in the country, so they don't even need to go to the central bank. They can just go to their own publicly owned banks and say, we want to build a railroad, and we need a loan, and we want it at low interest. And the bank will do it because they own the bank. So then the railroad gets built, it charges fees to the users, and then the fees pay the loan back. And that's the way it should be. That's what credit should be for. That's what government should do, is build things on credit, and then the things they build pay back the loan. You shouldn't have to hit up the taxpayers first. There's no reason not to just create it as credit. You're paying workers who are actually doing work, so you're giving them money for real goods and services. You're not just giving them money to invest in the stock market or the housing market for houses that are already built, which is where quantitative easing has gone to date in the speculative markets. You're giving money to workers to do something to add to GDP. So GDP goes up, the supply goes up along with the demand, and the prices remain stable. If you put the money into the stock market, for example, of course it's going to drive up the price of stocks across the board, because it's going to existing stocks. The money that goes to the stock market does not go back to the businesses. The only money the businesses get are from the initial public offering. After that, the stock is just a big casino. It's just going to the previous holder, and the people who buy it are just hoping to be able to sell it to someone else for more than they paid for it. So it's basically a casino. And that does drive up prices if you put extra money in there.
I'd like to take a moment to reintroduce you. We're a little past the bottom of the hour here, so you're listening to Corporations and Democracy, and our topic today is the recent progress of public banking in California, which we covered earlier in the program. We will get to the dangers of Facebook's new currency, the Libra, and for the time being, we're talking about the new book that came out just last month by our guest, Ellen Brown, who is the founder of the Public Banking Institute, and that new book is called Banking on the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age.
Yeah, why don't we talk a little bit about your book right now? What are you hoping to show people with your new edition?
Well, it's actually in two parts. So the first part is, it was actually an assignment from the Democracy Collaborative, who were the publishers. And they're a think tank in Washington, D.C., trying to come up with new solutions for fixing our ailing economy. And so they wanted a paper on how to eliminate too big to fail and a paper on how to create a national public banking system. And they wanted 50 pages each, and of course I ran way over. It turned out to be a much more challenging topic than I anticipated. And so I turned it into a book, and they agreed to publish it. So the first part is on why regulation won't work. We can't just tweak around the edges of the current system. It's the system itself is fundamentally flawed. And I would say the basic flaw is that money is created by banks when they make loans. They always want interest on those loans, so they always want more money back than they created. So even though you can figure out models where the money comes from here or there, over the whole system, debt always increases faster than the money supply. And so debt grows exponentially, whereas supply grows linearly, which means eventually the system's going to tip over. And that happens routinely, and those are the banking crises that we always get. Another problem is that the banks are always scrambling for liquidity because they are creating money that doesn't exist. And so they wind up drawing from the shadow banking system, which is totally unregulated. I won't even try to explain what it is, but it is unregulated and risky. But we need that shadow banking system under our existing system. That's why we need to overhaul the whole thing. We need to do it differently. We need to do it in some way where there is enough money to pay. If we're going to retain interest, which I think is actually not a bad idea, it serves certain purposes, then we need to keep adding more money to the system in order to cover that interest. So that's what they, for example, in China, the money supply has grown by a factor of 18 in the last 20 years. Like, it's 18 times larger than it was 20 years ago, which you would say, hyperinflation, that's got to drive prices up by 18 times. But it hasn't. Prices are still very low. I mean, at this very moment, they do have a little inflation problem because there was a big swine flu epidemic, so the cost of pork is going up. But right up till December of last year, they also were not even hitting a 2% inflation target, although they increased the money supply by a factor of 18. So that just shows you can, if you increase the money supply along with productivity, you can maintain your price level. It's not true that prices are always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, as Milton Friedman said, meaning that the more money you put in the system, the more it's going to drive up prices. That's only true if the money goes to a fixed supply. As long as the supply can meet the demand, then prices remain stable.
Mm-hmm. And so despite the obvious good examples in China and Japan, we don't get it. And I guess it's because it's not in the interest of the big banks to get it. And what other explanation could there be?
Well, agreed. But China and Japan have really created a new model, and I think we're just not really paying attention. That's why I keep writing, just to point that out, because people just aren't really aware of that. But, yeah, definitely most economists, I think, or writers tend to denigrate China because they're our big rivals. So they're always predicting that the Chinese economy is going to crash, that they're creating too much money or they have too much debt or something. But the thing about China, they don't care about the debt. Extra debt, they just carry that debt on their books. They don't put the banks into bankruptcy like we would, because a private bank has to balance its books. But a public bank can just carry the debt, just like the Federal Reserve can carry the debt. And in fact, that's how the Fed rescued the banks in 2008, was that it moved those toxic mortgages off the books of the private banks onto the Fed's own books. Mm-hmm. So essentially, that's what they do in China. They just carry the toxic debt, the debt that doesn't get repaid. They figure, oh, well, it's a little extra money that goes into the economy. We need a little extra money to cover the interest that isn't created in the original loans. I mean, I don't think they look at it that way, but they do just carry the debt, which means some money doesn't get paid back, which means the money supply grows, but it doesn't hurt anything as long as it's all aimed at productive activities.
And meanwhile, in the United States, we have the piling up owed interests, which you're in fact calling peak debt, which I guess is a hint about how serious you think that could be here.
Yeah, well, up until you hit peak debt, of course, you can just keep going further and further into debt. But at some point, which is where we are now, governments globally have so much debt that they really aren't allowed to spend anymore. You know, the conservatives balk and say you've got to balance your books, like particularly in Europe, where they have a limit on how far they can go into debt. And so they wind up, all their productivity goes into paying this past debt, which kills productivity and, you know, basically kills the economy. But you can get rid of that by just moving the debt onto your central bank so that nobody would be hurt. In ancient times, Michael Hudson has written about this in his latest book, Forgive Them Their Debts, that the ancient Sumerians, they issued money at interest, but and they knew that this would eventually overwhelm the system and they would hit peak debt and the thing would topple over. So what they did was they had routine debt jubilees where they just forgave the debt. But we can't do that today because the debt is not owed to the king or the emperor or the temple. It's owed to private bankers. But what we can do is just move the toxic debt onto the central bank or in some other way get extra money into the system to pay off the debts. Like a universal basic income, I think, is probably the most acceptable alternative. There are things like you could do a debt jubilee. Well, what Bernie Sanders is recommending right now, do a debt jubilee for students. But then you've got the problem that some students will say, well, I already paid off my debt. What about me?
Yeah,
and other people will say, my mortgage is underwater. How come the students get off and I don't? So yeah. A UBI would go to everybody, universal basic income.
We have a call that's come in, and I should have mentioned a few minutes ago that the number here, 895-2448, if you'd like to ask a question and join the conversation.
Hello, you're on the air with Ellen Brown.
Hi, it's Bill. I just have a question about China. I just turned off my speaker because it was acting weird. So let's see. If they've had an 18 time increase, they've had probably an 18 times increase in productivity. You know, the things that the money is backing, which is really activity, economic activity. And my question is, how long can that go on before we consume the whole planet? You know, I mean, it's nice that China is coming up to the living standards of us. It's sort of nice and sort of not nice because we're not living really very sustainably for the long haul. So I'm just wondering where that figures in and what happens when an economy stops growing because the earth stops growing.
Okay.
What has happened to Japan. Their GDP has not gone up and their money supply did not go up, even though they've moved all this debt onto the books of the central bank. So that just shows that the whole monetarist theory is wrong. But I agree, there is going to be a point where we can't necessarily produce more things, but we can put a lot of money. I mean, it seems to me you almost never run out of services that can be done. There are elderly people that need services. There, we can do research and development and find new, more economical ways to use the resources we have. I was just about to write on how hemp could solve the whole Green New Deal problem now that hemp has been legalized. I mean, that just opens up a whole new market of possible research, development, infrastructure, and products that can be made. So I don't know that people always need things, and if we run out of physical resources, we can reuse our physical resources in more efficient ways.
I'm just wondering, before we completely get off the subject of China, I know they have some apps that the people use there to exchange money through their phones back and forth. I guess several programs like that people here would just go ape bleep over. Do you want to talk about that? Was it AliChat or what are they?
Yeah, Alipay and WeChat Pay. Yep, they have dominated the market, the payments market, and it's very cheap, almost free. And so that is what Libra, the Facebook currency that's not really out yet, but they've just issued a white paper on it. That's what they're trying to emulate, but Libra is a lot scarier than Alipay and WeChat Pay because it's, well, I don't know if you want me to go into Libra, but so the way Alipay and WeChat Pay work is that they draw on banks, so they use the conventional system for exchange, but because one of them is a big sort of the Amazon of China, and the other is the big Facebook of China, so they already have these giant markets. So the whole idea is to sell products through their markets. They're not trying to make money on the exchange. So they're basically allowing these exchanges for free, particularly for small vendors, in order to get the vendors into their system so that you can buy the vendors' products, and it's the products that they want. But they are, the money is drawn originally from a bank, and so the banks are being cut out of the system, out of the usual perks of credit cards and all the things that, the liquidity, et cetera, all the things that banks normally profit from. So the banks are alarmed that this is cutting out the banks, but in China it doesn't matter so much because the banks are public, largely public, and you know, they've got other sources of liquidity. But in the U.S. with Libra, Libra is not even just an exchange system; it's a cryptocurrency. So you are going to take your U.S. dollars and buy this cryptocurrency. Your dollars are gone. There's no, it's totally unregulated. It's a shadow bank. You don't have any of the protections even of a bank or a credit card. For example, if you buy something and you don't get the right product, you can complain to your credit card company, but with Libra, you're not going to have that option. You just bought some Libra, and it's like Bitcoin, you know, a deal's a deal. It's cleared, but it's a lot scarier than Bitcoin because Facebook is so big, and they really could sort of mobilize a lot of people to use it. One problem is it's a consortium. It's owned by a consortium of big corporations, including Visa and MasterCard. You have to wonder why they want to join into the system that's theoretically going to be big competitors. But it's because they're going to get all this liquidity. They're going to get all this cash. And even though they say they're going to separate it from Facebook so they won't have all your personal data, they could change the rules at any time. It's a private corporate cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. It's not even a cryptocurrency because it's not really on a blockchain, and it's not really crypto. I mean, it's not really secret. They know who you are. And even though they say right now that they're not going to draw on your data or all the information they have from your Facebook account, they could change the terms at any time because they're private. You know, you get those notices from your bank that say, we've changed the terms of your credit card or something, and it's 20 pages or something, and you're supposed to check the box, but nobody ever reads it. You know, you don't know exactly what terms got changed. They could change the terms and say, we're now going to use your personal information for, you know, for advertisers or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's quite scary and interesting. We'll see how it develops.
So this would make...
But I suspect it'll get regulated. Go ahead.
How would they regulate it? I mean, who would be able to? Facebook would become kind of its own virtual country with people that belong to that country from wherever they choose to draw them.
Yeah, well, they can just declare that it's a bank or it's a security, and that they have to jump through all these hoops that banks have to jump through and make them be subject to regulations. Or like China has banned cryptocurrencies, they could just ban cryptocurrencies. You know, President Trump just today, I think, or yesterday, tweeted that Libra was dangerous, and a danger to the U.S. dollar. So they're looking at it.
Well, so in the case that the Libra collapsed, unlike dollars in the bank, you have no recourse.
So, exactly.
You know, consumers
who's going to bail them out when they collapse?
Yeah, right.
You can't even look to Congress because it's not federally regulated.
Mm-hmm. So it would seem we have something that Trump and Maxine Waters both agree on.
Oh, my goodness.
Right.
Well, getting toward the end here, we just have, you know, a little over 5 minutes left to talk about it. What I would like to bring up a point that you've made recently, and there's all of the progressive Democrats that are new on the scene and have the vision of the Green New Deal, and everybody's always saying, well, how are you going to pay for it? I think you have the answer, don't you?
Well, you can say, in the original Green New Deal proposal, it said that it was going to be funded by a combination of the Federal Reserve, a national public bank, or a network of public banks. So that would do it, it seems to me. But the first thing you have to do with the Federal Reserve is turn it into a public utility. So you need to change the banking laws a bit. But Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act in the first place, and they're always tinkering with it, like the Dodd-Frank Act changed some of the terms in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So they could change it again, and they could change it the way China and Japan have it and say that the central bank has to work with the Treasury in coming up with economic policies. So fiscal policy and monetary policy have to work together, fiscal policy being the Congress spending money and monetary policy being the central bank regulating the amount of money that's out there.
Okay, so we have the public banking and we have hemp, so we can have a Green New Deal. One thing I wanted to resurrect that we didn't get to, which is kind of important in our banking structure, is that you've said that the feds don't see crashes when they're coming because they're not looking in the right places.
Well, in that particular case, they weren't looking at the repo market, which is part of the shadow banking system, which is unregulated. So the regulated banks were pretty well protected, and they figured, well, we can't have a crash because we've got all these protections in place. But the shadow banking system is, by definition, it's operating in the shadows, and nobody really knows what's happening until it happens. And so they came out with all kind. Well, they came out with the Dodd-Frank Act, which was like 2,300 pages, and they still didn't fix the problem. They're trying to regulate the shadow banks, but well, they didn't even actually address the shadow banks so much. That mostly Dodd-Frank was aimed at the regular banks, which weren't the problem in the first place, or the major problem, and that was one complaint about Dodd-Frank, was that it really hurt the small banks,
mm-hmm.
that all these regulations were imposed, forcing them to sell out to the big banks. In fact, some people say that was the whole point, that
yeah,
the big
sure.
banks were behind it. They wanted to consolidate.
It sure undermines confidence, that the public would like to have in the government, that the people who could solve this problem aren't really trying to. Maybe it has something
right.
to do with the campaign donations they get from those big banks.
If you
right,
want to have...
And they really can't even keep up. I mean, by the time they pass some legislation, shadow banking is, by definition, they're always working around things. They can get around the rules. They can come up with new ways of getting around the rules. So you really need, I think you really need to change the whole system, make it public. You could leave the private banks, and if people can't get a loan from the public bank or they want to speculate or something, they can borrow from the private banks. But you don't need to the reason the private banks have done so well is they're FDIC insured. We're protecting their deposits.
Mm-hmm.
So we, the people, have to step in when the thing collapses. So we could take away that by, opening up the Federal Reserve or the public banking system to the public, and then let the private banks basically be revolving funds or like investment funds.
I thought I read a few years ago that the actual monetary backing for deposits was not nowhere near enough to actually cover it.
Right.
The deposits.
I looked, I think they had something like maybe $75 billion, and the deposits are over $10
trillion. Yeah.
I mean, not all of them are FDIC insured, but I think $6 trillion or so are FDIC insured.
So again, Ellen's new book is Banking on the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age, just out. And if you want a really good time, you should look at the appendix, because she has a history of America's changes in the money system, which you describe as almost trial and error, going back to the colonies. Almost every 30 years, there's some new little tweak. And we have a call. We have two calls online. I'm so sorry. We are out of time almost. And why do you wait till the last minute, dear listeners?
Let's make sure that we mention the where the book can be gotten, other than local independent bookstores, of course. And online, you have a website for your work, which is at ellenbrown.com. And what is after the dot?
Okay, ellenbrown.com is my own website. And then, of course, it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and different online outlets.
Yep.
And the Democracy Collaborative as well, which is the publisher.
Yeah. By the way, that is the collaborative that, in which is involved Gar Alperovitz, I believe.
Right.
Who has also been our guest on the program. Some listeners will recognize that. And then there is the publicbankinginstitute.org, which has plenty of information about the public banking efforts. And I should mention the few of your recent articles is where some of the content for today's program came from. Those are also at ellenbrown.com, including your most recent article, How to Pay for It All, an Option the Candidates Missed, talking about what's not being talked about by candidates in the debates and such, the presidential candidates.
Okay, thank you, Ellen Brown, so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you. It was great talking to you.
All righty.
You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy, broadcast each second and fourth Tuesday from 11 to 12 here on KZYX and Z. I'm sorry, second and fourth Fridays. The next edition of Corporations and Democracy will be in 2 weeks. That's July 26th, with alternating host Linda McClure. Andy and I will return on Friday, August 9th. For further information about what you can do to correct the corporate dominance of democracy, and for an archive of this program, go to www.thealliancefordemocracy.org. And thanks for listening.
Not your property.